couple of weeks ago, I was talking to my Muslim taxi driver about Jesus. And I'm not entirely sure quite how he got onto that topic. But he was clearly very anti-drink. And he was sort of suggesting that Jesus would have been as well, till I said, well, he did turn water into wine at a wedding, and he and his disciples were known as drunkards and gluttons. And then it became clear he was also very much against gay marriage. And he said, we really ought to get back to the Ten Commandments. Yeah, we've had the Ten Commandments read, and of course there was nothing in them about that topic either. I wondered then, what about them? And saw that it was our Old Testament reading this morning, these Ten Commandments, dating as they do from about 1200 BC. Well, we see God acting, don't we, getting involved with Israel, making a covenant with them, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt where you were slaves. He's clearly acted in their history, showing that he cares about them and for them. And so these Ten Commandments deal with our relationship with God and with each other. I think we need to notice, though, and take note carefully, that the Old Testament is clearly pre-Christian, 1200 BC, and in many parts it's sub-Christian as well. But it doesn't mean that we can't learn something from the Ten Commandments. They've certainly lasted. In many areas, they're the basis of law. They're in the scriptures that we have, and that the Jews have, and that Muslims have as well. And if they were lived by everyone, they'd certainly transform society. And they ask us questions. I'm not going to go through the whole lot. I was a bit worried when I told one or two people I was talking about the Ten Commandments, and they said, what, all of them? And then I thought, well, people have written long books about them, you know, so you're not going to be here till this afternoon. Well, do we put God first? Are we to have no other gods before him? He's number one. It doesn't mean we can't have other things that engage our interest and energy. But do we put him first? And if we do, is it out of love or out of fear? You know, do we think he's the sort of God who's angry and needs to be appeased to keep him on side? Do we have idols? Things we worship, or things that define but might limit God? Baptists have always gone for totally austere buildings. Nothing inside that could distract you. Just a pulpit very high, where the preacher can see everybody in the congregation and is 6 feet above contradiction, you know. But no colour, very often not even a cross. So I wonder, do we worship our buildings or the layout more than God? I suspect not here, but I mean, banners are okay, statues of Stations of the Cross or the saints or the Virgin Mary. Probably not, but is there a major difference between banners and statues? I love to go somewhere. I went to Walsingham and I loved looking at all the statues there. But then it was a unique experience for me, so perhaps I did. We need to be careful, you know, that if you want to move an altar, it's a big deal. You want to move the pews in a certain church, or change the liturgy, or anything else. You know, Baptists never have liturgies, they just have a hymn sandwich, you see, but you can't change that. I mean, if you change where the prayers are, it's a disaster. So things that, you know, do we have things that get in the way? Are we careless in our use of God's name? John Bunyan used to swear, linking it to that, I suppose. Then he tells how he gave up swearing, and he adds, now I could, without it, speak better and with more pleasantness than ever I could before. So there's a thought, next time I miss my short putt at golf, or Peterborough miss an open goal, you know, there we are, yes. Do we keep the Lord's day holy and do no work? Things are a bit different now from when that was written. Then there were no power stations, there were no emergency services, no hospitals. I mean, if you go into a hospital at the weekends now, you are more likely to die because the staffing level is much lower. Nationally, the figures show a higher percentage. Well, we don't think that's right, do we? And Jesus healed on the Sabbath. And look what he got told off for it as well. When I was growing up, we weren't a particularly Christian household, but we didn't do pleasure on a Sunday. The only time I can remember was we were on holiday at Bude, and it had been a very wet first week, and the Sunday morning dawned fine and sunny, and I got permission, even from Grandad, to go for a row on the Bude Canal, which I love doing. I got to the far end, and the heavens opened, and I got soaked to the skin. And I had the embarrassing experience of walking through the centre of Bude back to the boarding house at exactly the same time that everybody was coming out of church. And me sat dripping wet and everybody coming out in dark suits. I felt about so tall. And if you had talked to me then about, you know, retribution and things like that, I might have been inclined to believe it. You could go to church virtually all day, couldn't you? Morning service, Sunday school in the afternoon, church in the evening. Here's a comment from a commentary written in the 1950s. When mother protests that after washing, dressing and feeding the children, getting her husband's Sunday clothes ready, preparing the Sunday dinner and arriving at church nearly on time, she objects to the minister giving out as the opening hymn, O Day of Rest and Gladness. However, her attention should be drawn to the fact that nothing is said about mother resting on the Sabbath. And the commentary concludes that section by saying, the Bible never asks for the impossible. So mothers are presumably able to slave away all day. And I trust those of you that are married, I hope all you wives put out your husband's Sunday clothes. Perhaps you do. Perhaps you should. I leave it with you. You didn't. Right. His wife's not here. Yes. Lovely. But from the foundation of these four comes how we live together in community, the next six. I mean, if we all did, as I've said, the transformation in our world would be mind-blowing. And if anyone says to you they're totally outdated and that we don't need them at all, then just imagine what chaos there would be if everyone did the reverse. If everybody stole, if everybody, you know, committed adultery, if everybody, I mean, and everybody envied. It would be absolutely chaos in our world. Because you see, our behaviour to each other, it all has a ripple effect. It affects others, sometimes in unforeseen ways. And these commandments can challenge us. I mean, honour your father and mother. I think there were certainly times when I didn't honour my father because I didn't think he deserved it. And I noticed that in the New Testament, Paul writes, fathers, don't exasperate your children. But is that just a cop-out, you see? When government and others talk about the importance of the stability of families and relationships between parents and children, it isn't something from just 1200 BC. It's something that's very important for us today, isn't it? What about stealing? I think most of us are going to go out tonight and burgle anywhere. But what about economic systems that steal from and exploit the poor and vulnerable? Are we complicit in that? Headline, yesterday's Times. Criminal cartels run thousands of slaves in Britain. Reckoned to be, according to a government regulator, there could be more than 13,000 slaves in the country because labour exploitation offered high profits, but the risk of prosecution is quite low. Picking leeks and cabbages in the fields around Wisbeach is hard work. Some of the workers, after they've paid their expenses, were left with 40p to spend at the end of the week. And there's something here, that's right. Police forces are reluctant to tackle slavery because it's unsexy. and investigators will not be seen as heroes, a report has found. This is across Europe. One European police chief said that while a detective who stops a van containing 200 kilograms of cocaine is a hero, an officer stopping a van with six possible trafficking victims would not be thanked. One senior police officer interviewed said he thought prosecution rates for trafficking offences were low across Europe because of attitudes. And he said if the police put as much effort into that as they do as into tracing drugs, well, we might get on top of the problem. But there are people here being robbed of their freedom and their money and whatever, and we buy the fruit and vegetables, yeah, could be judged to be slightly complicit. We may not actively covet or be green with envy over our neighbour's possessions, but advertising urges us, if not in as many words, to keep up with the Joneses, to that there are gadgets we must have, furniture we must have. I mean, the DFS sale goes on permanently, it seems to me, doesn't it? And the years for interest-free credit seem to range from about 3 to 5, you know, and you see these pictures of sofas that fit in the corner and fit everywhere else, and we must have them. And then the B&Q ad that your home is magically transformed, isn't it, by the walls sort of changing round, and it becomes a totally new place. And so I leave you to read them and work it out. I think what begins to emerge from this is that actually God is passionate about us and about everyone. And he wants us to catch his vision of abundant life for everyone. He's passionate about justice and right and truth. I mean, he says, doesn't he, the whole law is summed up as loving God and our neighbour as ourselves. And he goes on to say that this can mean even our enemies. Now, how unrealistic is that in today's world, or any world? Not, of course, that hating them seems to get us very far either. His manifesto ministry launch, we're going to be having enough manifesto launches in the next few weeks. But his is from Isaiah 61. He stands up and reads it as good news to the poor, release for prisoners, freedom for captives, binding up the brokenhearted. And he wants justice to flow like a mighty river. I mean, it's mind-blowing, isn't it? In the gospel reading, some commentators say that it's primarily corruption that makes him so angry in the temple, that the people who went there to turn their whatever they had into sacrificial products and money were getting fleeced and actually sort of cheated, and he got very cross. There might be other reasons as well, but clearly he cares, you see, and he cares with a love that never ends, that we know goes on believing the best. And that's almost crazy, isn't it? Believing the best in other people. Might be all right to imagine him believing the best in us as respectable middle-class Englishmen, primarily. Apologies to, you know, but you know what I mean. Whereas if you look in the headlines of the papers, the traffickers, the murderers, the you name it, it goes on loving them with a love that never ends. Certainly seems foolish, and certainly seems so when he died on the cross. That yes, it was love was okay, but his life was snuffed out. But as an Easter hymn says, Christ is alive, and comes to bring new life to this and every age, till earth and all creation ring with joy, with justice, love and praise. And this is the promise, that in God's passionate love, not restricted to one or two people, the good and the high and mighty, but God's passionate love for everybody in the world, there is real hope. For you see, love changes everything. Hands and faces, earth and sky. Love changes everything. How you live and how you die. Love will turn your world around. And that world will last forever. Yes, love. Love changes everything. Brings you glory. Brings you shame. Nothing in the world will ever be the same. Yes, love. Love changes everyone. Live or perish in its flame. Love will never, never let you be the same. Love will never, never let you be the same. And may that be our experience. May our lives echo the prayer we're going to pray at the end of our intercessions, when we pray that God's kingdom will come and his will be done here on earth as in heaven. And may God change our love from a spark to a flame. Amen.